The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, songwriters call time on pop stars' unearned credits. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when we confirmed who's going to be appearing on our Music Copyright Explained panels.
We did.
That's the news everyone was talking about.
We did indeed. We've confirmed that. So a couple of weeks ago on Setlist, we talked about this new Music Copyright Explained guide that we have produced for the UK's Intellectual Property Office, which you can download for free from musiccopyrightexplained.com. And to sort of, you know, coincide with that guide coming out, we are presenting three, count them, not one, not two, but three separate panel discussions online, obviously, this coming week, all about all the different topics and debates and conversations to be had around music copyright in 2021. And so, yes, we published more information. We published the topic titles weeks ago, but we've actually now confirmed the speakers who are going to be taking part. So these are happening, assuming you're listening to this podcast on the Monday that it comes out. These are happening this Tuesday, Wednesday.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you? You would all be downloading it just on the off chance, the slight off chance that there's a time sensitive plug in the intro. That's why you all download it as soon
they'll tune in,
as soon as it appears in your feed. So yeah, assuming you're listening to this as the podcast goes out, this Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we've got three different conversations. On Tuesday, we're looking at it more from a sort of a music maker, artist, songwriter, music industry perspective. On Wednesday, looking at it more from the perspective of people making use of music, whether that is creators or media companies or people thinking of setting up digital music services. Yeah, probably don't. But if you are, you have to tune into our discussion on that, where we'll talk about the ins and outs of it all. And then on the Thursday, we're looking at how we educate both music makers and other creators about things like music copyright, how we can do that better. So those are the topics we're going to be talking about. Along the way, we will be joined by artist and FAC board member Roxanne DeBastian, Lucy Caswell from the Music Publishers Association, Naomi Pohl from the Musicians Union, Simon Pursehouse from Centric Music. They're all taking part in the first conversation on Tuesday. We've got Sophie Goosens from Reed Smith, Rafaela DeSantis from Harbottle & Lewis, and music licensing expert Becky Brook on Wednesday. And on Thursday, we'll be joined by rapper and FAC advocate Shoudo. We'll also be joined by Shawnee Caballero, who is the founder of a brilliant rights agency called the Go2 Agency, who works with lots of rappers and grime and drill artists, helping them sort out their rights. Plus, we'll be joined by artist manager Phil Nelson, who is also an educator at BIM and works with us at CMU on our Pathways into Music programs. And they are the people who are going to be joining me. These are free, these panels. So if you are interested, if you go to musiccopyrightexplained.com and you'll see that down the bottom of the homepage, there is the link through to the panels page. And then you click on a button, tell us your email address, and we will sign you up for one, two, or three of those. So that's one of the things that we announced this last week. But despite how it may sometimes seem, This podcast does not just exist for us to plug all of our own stuff. So therefore, because of that, that is not actually what we're here to talk about this week.
No, later on, we're going to be discussing a fun legal battle between Ice Cube and the stock trading app Robinhood, which is, it is a really fun lawsuit. And who doesn't love a fun lawsuit? We love a fun lawsuit. You must do too, because you're listening. So stick around for that. But first, a number of songwriters in the US last week backed a new campaign that seeks to stop famous artists from grabbing a cut of the copyright in songs that they helped make famous but didn't actually write. The songwriters speaking out about this practice say that artists doing this has become normalised in the music industry, but that's because there has been no real unity within the songwriting community to fight back. Until now.
Yeah, so this is one of a number of campaigns that have come out of the songwriting community in recent months. In fact, I think this is possibly the third edition of Setlist in a row where we've been talking about one of these campaigns.
Songwriters are really in campaign mode at the moment. I mean, they have been. There have been a lot of songwriter campaigns over the last few years, but in the last 3 months, they've been like more than that whole time put together.
So let's talk about this specific campaign, because actually this is quite interesting and it's been picked up by lots of mainstream media as well as the music industry press. It is coming out.
Well, it's got pop stars in it, hasn't it? It's got pop stars in it. And who doesn't love pop stars? Especially thieving evil pop stars.
Yeah, it's not the pop stars doing the campaigning. The pop stars, albeit so far anonymously, are being criticised in this particular campaign.
We know who they are.
The campaign is coming out of the US, although it has also been endorsed by many songwriters here in the UK as well already. So this is all to do with the fact, as every Setlist listener knows, and if you don't, you need to go and download that Music Copyright Explained guide I was just talking about. But there are two sets of music copyright. There are recording rights and there are song rights, and they are separate. So when you have a recording of a song, there are two sets of copyright going on. And usually, the recording rights will be owned either by the main artist who releases the track, or traditionally, it more likely, the copyright would be owned by that artist's record label. And then the label would share any money with the artist, or actually, maybe the other way around. If the artist owns the copyright, they will work with a label or a distributor to monetize the recordings and share the money. But separate to that, it's the song copyright. And the song copyright separately earns money every time the recording is used. And of course, if the song is used anywhere else, if it's recorded by other artists, the song continues to earn money. And the song copyright, by default, under law, is owned by whoever writes the song. And obviously, songs these days are frequently co-written, so there's more than one person involved. And the law says that those people co-own the copyright. So, in theory, where you've got a scenario where you've got an artist over here who makes the recording, but they don't actually get involved in writing the song. And then you've got songwriters over here who are writing the song. Then that's two separate teams of people who will then have a stake in two separate copyrights. Of course, plenty of artists also write, plenty of writers also record. So there is quite often a bit of crossover there. But if you have sort of the classic pop star setup, I guess, where you do have a pop star who's a brilliant singer, a brilliant performer, they have a big fan base, they're over here in partnership with a record label on the recording side, and then over here you've got the songwriters writing the songs. And in theory, those should be two separate rights, two separate sets of ownership. The artist and the label get the recording money, the songwriters and any music publishers they work with get the song money, and it's all separate, unless the pop star over here decides that they want a cut of the song copyright too.
Yeah, so one of the ways in which an artist might claim a portion of a song that they're recording is to change some of the lyrics and then say that they were a writer on the song. There's an old legal cliche, add a word, get a third. I think that's fairly self-explanatory how that works. So basically, if you're in the studio, you do a lot, like maybe change one or two words in the song and you say, okay, now I own a portion of that song. That's mine now. I wrote this. Although sometimes it's not even that subtle. It might be that even before the artist has gone into the studio to record the song, there has been a condition laid down that if this artist is going to record your song, you have to give up a portion of the copyright in that song to them. And they're not even going to bother just slightly tinkering with it to get their cut. And sometimes that can be a pretty significant piece of that copyright too. So the argument that would be presented to the songwriter is that dividing up your cut of that song with a big name artist who makes it a hit will ultimately be better for you than owning a larger piece of a song that no one has heard of. And that argument's not untrue. I mean, you are going to earn more money from a song that becomes a hit than one that disappears without a trace, even if you only own 20% rather than 40%. But in the context of the current big debate in the music community, whereby songwriters argue that, unlike the record industry, they are not yet seeing the benefit of the streaming boom, it seems just more unethical for a recording artist to demand a cut of the writer's primary and often only income stream.
Yeah, and I guess that's an important point here, isn't it? That songwriters almost exclusively depend on the money made by their rights, whereas a pop star has many different revenue streams. And if you go back even to the 2000s, I mean, this practice of pop stars demanding a cut of the song rights or the publishing on the songs that they make famous, I mean, it's not new. I mean, it goes all the way back at least to sort of the Elvis Presley era. I mean, Elvis's manager was famous for demanding a cut of publishing for Elvis on all the songs that he performed and recorded, oblivious of whether or not he had any involvement in the writing process. So it's not new. But I think it is true that over the years, it has become ever more common. And I suppose in the 2000s, you had an era when recorded music was slumping. The value of recorded music every year was going down for all the various different reasons that we don't have time to get into today. But, you know, let's just say for the record industry, the shift to digital was traumatic. And so you had these 10 years where recorded music was becoming less and less valuable. And I think during that time, more artists started to say, well, if I'm going to make less out of recordings because the value is going down, might I have a cut of the song rights? And you also started, I think, having session musicians as well, also saying, well, actually, my role in the studio is in essence a co-write role. So should I be getting a cut of publishing? And to be fair to session musicians, in many cases, those session musicians who said that were kind of right. I mean, if you go back to sort of the 70s and the 80s, there are lots of tracks with famous little bits of the track which were actually improvised by the session musicians in the studio. And really, those session musicians should have been getting a cut of the copyright on the song side as a result of that. But often in that era, it never even occurred to session musicians to be saying, hey, hang on a second, that whole string section or guitar solo or piano bit that I just improvised, actually, maybe I should have a cut of the song copyright. But my point is, in the 2000s, because the value of recorded music was going down, more people started to ask for a cut of the song rights. And again, you can kind of understand why that was happening. Although even then, plenty of songwriters pointed out that, hey, as a pop star, yes, we know that one of the revenue streams you've always relied on, sound recording revenue streams, is in decline. But as an artist, you also have your live income. The live industry is booming. Merchandise. There are so many more opportunities to sell merchandise because the whole direct-to-fan thing is taking off. Brand partnerships are becoming a bigger deal in music. As an artist, yes, your rights revenue stream is wobbling. This is in the 2000s, remember. Actually, now, the sound recording rights are becoming more valuable. But even then, yes, recording rights are becoming less valuable, but you have all of these other revenue streams, whereas songwriters over here, we only have our rights revenue stream. And to an extent, if recorded music is becoming less valuable, songwriters are affected by that too. I mean, songwriters do have other revenue streams because, you know, songwriters earn when music gets performed live, which means that they do benefit from the boom in live music. The sync market was growing at that time, and that really benefits songwriters and composers. But my point is, even in the 2000s, when recorded music was slumping, and maybe that gave a reason why more artists asked for a cut of publishing, in a way, it's still right for songwriters to point out, well, you have all of these other revenue streams. I have one, my rights. So therefore, you shouldn't be trying to take my rights. Plus, if you didn't co-write the song, you didn't co-write the song. I mean, why, just from a moral rights perspective, why are you seeking the credit when you didn't actually contribute anything to the songwriting process? So yeah, I think our point is, this is not a new phenomenon, although it's possibly increased over the years and decades. And while that argument, better to have 20% of a hit than 40, 50, 60, 100% of a song nobody's heard of, while that's a valid argument, it still doesn't seem fair, and actually has never really seemed fair.
So this was all laid out in an open letter published by a group going by the name of The Pact last week, and the letter was signed by various songwriters, including Amy Allen, Ross Golan, Billy Mann, Emily Warren, lots of known pop songwriters. And in this letter, they said, "Over the last few years, there has been a growing number of artists that are demanding publishing on songs they did not write. These artists will go on to collect from touring, merchandise, brand partnerships, and many other revenue streams, while songwriters have only their publishing revenue as a means of income. This demand for publishing is often able to happen because the artists and or their representation abuse leverage, use bully tactics and threats, and prey upon writers who may choose to give up some of their assets rather than lose an opportunity completely. Over time, this practice of artists taking publishing has become normalised, and until now, there has been no real unity within the songwriting community to fight back. That is why we have decided to join together in support of each other and make a change." They then go on, "This body of songwriters will not give publishing or songwriting credit to anyone who did not create or change the lyric or melody or otherwise contribute to the composition without a reasonably equivalent or meaningful exchange for all the songwriters on the song."
Yeah, so a pretty bold statement there from, as you say, a group of very successful songwriters who've worked with lots of different pop stars over the years. So that is them basically saying, that's it. You know, yes, obviously, when we work with pop stars who come very much into the studio, it's a collaborative process. They're very much involved in the composition process, even if it's just on the lyric side. Obviously, then we are co-creators, we co-own the copyright. But where we are basically writing the song, and actually one of the songwriters who was interviewed by Variety, I think, sort of expanded on some of this, and they were talking about, or maybe it was their manager, I can't remember, how sometimes, obviously, in the process where you have a team of songwriters, and maybe they work with producers or their producers themselves, and they work on a song, and then they're liaising with an A&R at a label who then has an artist who wants to record the song, and the artist management gets involved. But during that process, usually the songwriters will do a demo. This is what the song sounds like. And this, either it was the writer or the manager, I can't remember, was basically saying, you know, sometimes we send the demo across, and then we get the recording back from the label who've done the studio bit of the process, and it is identical to the demo. They've just taken out the vocals of whether one of the writers actually does the vocals or they have a session vocalist who do the vocals. They just take out those vocals and put the pop star's vocals in. It's exactly the same. And yet the pop star or their manager or their team or whoever is still demanding 20, 30, 40% of the song copyright, even though they literally took a demo recording, listened to the vocals, recorded an identical version of the vocals, and then that was pretty much it.
I think it's interesting, though, why this has become such a, as they say, normalised practice in recent years, whereas it's, you know, as we said, not a new thing, but why is it now becoming more and more prevalent? And I think, obviously, you know, going back to the Elvis days, it goes back to greedy managers wanting to secure as much money for their artists and therefore their own cut as possible. But I don't think that can be the only reason why this is becoming more and more of a frequent thing. I think partly in recent years, it's become more and more important for pop stars to be seen to be writing their own songs and songs to be about them personally. And partly I think that's because a pop star's brand has become so much more about them and their life, and actually their music is part of something wider. They're asking their fans to buy into their lives now, particularly with the growth of social media. So it's more and more important for those songs to be seen as a reflection of that pop star's life, and therefore their fans want to see those songs being written by the pop star themselves about their personal experience.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever fallen into a YouTube hole of watching reaction videos of people reacting to music videos and to songs and tracks. I had a couple of instances where I fell into holes, mainly because I find it amusing watching reaction videos to Queen's Under Pressure and then seeing all the Queen fans in the comments getting very angry when the reactor says, "Oh, they've used that bit from Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby." But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about.
Which, my point, obviously, Vanilla Ice tried to claim that he did write. That's a whole other story, isn't it?
But I'm sort of coming to your point that sometimes those reactors are reacting to songs which I know the singer didn't write. I know who wrote the song. But they'll be saying things like, oh, clearly what this singer is saying is this, and it maybe relates to the fact that I know that this happened in the singer's life. And you're sort of sitting there thinking, yeah, they didn't write those lyrics. Somebody else wrote those lyrics. They're about something completely different. But I suppose in a way, and this is kind of the point I think we're probably both trying to make, and I did see this point being made in my social feeds once this open letter and petition started to gain momentum, is why are we expecting pop stars to write their own songs? I think there's two elements to that. First of all, you know, if you are a brilliant vocalist and a brilliant recording performer, and you're brilliant on stage, and you're very compelling in the live space, and you've built an audience online, and you interact with that audience online, why are we saying that on top of that, you have to be a brilliant songwriter to be a legitimate musician? Now, of course, some pop stars are, and that's brilliant, but I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with relying on a team of other writers and producers to be actually creating the music. And of course, you know, I think it is fair to say that you can take somebody else's lyrics, which were very possibly written about something completely different that was personal to the writer, but then you can sort of almost translate them in a way so that you're presenting them much more that they are about you personally or the character that you're playing on stage and so on and so forth. But yeah, as I say, I saw this in my social feed, a number of people saying, is part of this that there's this kind of stigma to be a pop star who doesn't really get involved in the songwriting process. And actually, that's a stupid stigma. We should accept that a pop star can be brilliant without writing their own songs. And maybe, yeah, there's always going to be greedy pop stars, and there's always going to be greedy managers and teams who just want to cut up publishing because it's easy money. But also, is it partly that pop stars feel the need to pretend that they are involved in the songwriting process, and that's why they want to get their name in the credits?
So an interesting debate, and it'll be interesting to see if this campaign has any significant success in turning this around. But the letter concludes, we are simply asking that we are not put in positions where we are forced to give up all we have in exchange for nothing. We are simply asking that we give credit where credit is due and only take credit where credit is earned.
And if you are a songwriter, and this is a particular bugbear of yours, then if you go to the PAX website, you can put your name to that letter as well.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
And finally this week, we promised you a fun lawsuit, and a fun lawsuit is coming up right now. Ice Cube has sued the company behind the Robin Hood stock trading app. He accuses it of infringing his trademark and publicity rights by using his image and quote-unquote catchphrase on a post on its financial news website, Robin Hood Snacks. Now, I know that when I first read this story, I was interested to know what Ice Cube's catchphrase is, and all will be revealed in a moment. But Chris, why do we all know the name of the Robin Hood app suddenly?
Yeah, so you may remember at the start of the year, the Robin Hood app became newsworthy because of that whole GameStop thing that was happening, which was, let's see if I can explain this now, a group of people on a Reddit subgroup all started buying shares in the US gaming retailer GameStop, which, like most high street entertainment retailers, has been struggling in recent years. And it was ultimately all about screwing over a bunch of hedge funds on Wall Street who were, to use the jargon term, short selling GameStop's stock, which is seen as being a little bit of an unethical practice in Wall Street, where investor types make a lot of money, but ultimately can screw over and ruin companies in the process. And so in order to screw over the hedge funds who were allegedly screwing over GameStop, these casual investors, as part of this subreddit, all started buying GameStop shares in order to hike up the share price. So that was what the news story was. A lot of them were using this Robinhood app. And then the app had two roles in the story. First of all, when the whole thing first started to happen and GameStop share price suddenly started surging and it was reported, oh yeah, a lot of these Reddit casual investors are using the Robinhood app in order to buy stocks because it's an app that makes it easier to buy shares and stocks in companies. But then it became a bigger part of the story because for a time, the Robinhood app stopped people from buying and selling GameStop shares and a few other shares, I think, for other companies on its app. As that whole thing was gaining momentum, it then got a big backlash, including by a number of people in US Congress, basically saying that that was market manipulation and they were just protecting the interests of these evil, sinister hedge funds. So this Robinhood app got a lot of press while all of that was in the news, not all of it positive. And that's why we've heard of the Robinhood app. But I guess none of that explains why Ice Cube has a beef with this company.
Well, back in early March, the Robinhood Snacks website, which is a news site run by Robinhood, illustrated a story with a picture of Ice Cube that was accompanied by the caption, "Correct yourself before you wreck yourself," which is obviously a play on the lyric, "You better check yourself before you wreck yourself," from Ice Cube's 1993 track, Check Yourself. And if you guessed Check Yourself Before You Wreck Yourself as Ice Cube's catchphrase, have a biscuit. Anyway, he's not happy with that at all. And he's now arguing that Robinhood Snacks is basically a promotional website that exists to sell financial services offered by the wider Robinhood business.
But we said that this was a fun lawsuit. And the reason why it's a fun lawsuit is that Ice Cube's lawyers are basically saying that because Robinhood used Ice Cube's image on this promotional, albeit editorial-driven website, that that's them using Ice Cube's trademark and his image and personality to sell their services. They don't like that. And they don't like the fact that Ice Cube has been associated with the company that was embroiled in this controversy around the whole GameStop thing a couple of months ago. And actually, they reckon, and this is where the lawsuit gets fun, that this Robinhood company has been involved in a lot of controversy that Ice Cube does not want to be associated with. And, well, they're quite forthright in describing why this company is such a terrible company that no decent rapper would want to be associated with.
And speaking of decent rappers, we'll get onto those in a minute too. But yeah, so this lawsuit says, Robinhood is an unscrupulous and predatory conglomerate that professes to be a financial services company for the everyday person. In truth, Robinhood is a wolf in sheep's clothing. It is the archetypal example of an amoral corporation that places profit over people. And if you thought they were going to calm down from there, you would be wrong. They go on, Robinhood's corporate malfeasance is no secret. Over the course of its brief existence, Robinhood has been A, the subject of investigations too numerous to list, but currently by not less than 5 separate government bodies. B, fined several times by federal regulatory services, including, most recently, a $65 million settlement with the SEC in December 2020. And C, named as a defendant in hundreds of lawsuits, including, currently, over 50 class action lawsuits. No wonder. They go on. In 2020 alone, it was widely reported that Robinhood's stock trading app, which depends on trigger finger immediacy, went down not less than 90 separate times. Robinhood is selling a garbage trading platform to the American public and laughing all the way to the bank.
So these are all reasons why, if you were Ice Cube, you wouldn't want people...
Or another respectable rapper.
You wouldn't want anyone to be thinking that you were formally linked to this organization and endorsing it and promoting it. And you've mentioned these other rappers. So yeah, elsewhere in the lawsuit, it notes... Because you might be thinking, well, hang on a second. This Robinhood Snacks, it's basically a blog that the company runs where they report on things happening in the financial space, and they just illustrated one of their stories with a picture of Ice Cube. You might be thinking, well, why would anybody seeing a picture of Ice Cube on a blog on this financial services company's website, why would they think that that constituted endorsement? Well, the reason they might think that is because this company has had formal alliances with certain rappers in the past.
Yes, not just rappers, but there are a couple of rappers who Ice Cube's lawsuit hones in on. It says, in a cynical effort to appeal to a young demographic, Robin Hood has engaged celebrity endorsers like Jay-Z, Nas, and non-rapper Jared Leto. It doesn't say non-rapper, but I just want to make sure you know I know who Jared Leto is. He's not a rapper. Anyway, it's used all of them to endorse its products and services. However, in an act of unmitigated gall and transparent retribution, Robin Hood and its subsidiary have now used the image and likeness of Ice Cube without his permission to promote Robin Hood's terrible products and services. It concludes, Robin Hood has picked on the wrong man this time.
Now, I know why he name checks Jay-Z and Nas in the lawsuit, because he's basically saying this is a reason why, even though this was just a photo on a blog, people might assume it's some sort of endorsement. They're trying to ramp up the fact that people could have been confused into thinking that there was endorsement here, and that's why Ice Cube's trademark rights and his publicity rights, the former under US federal law, the latter under Californian law, have been infringed. Although, I don't know, if you want to be a bit cynical, you can almost read it as he's kind of a bit pissed off that they actually did a sort of, I mean, I assume this is what they did. I've not done any digging on this, but it certainly what the lawsuit is implying is they had some sort of formal marketing partnership with Jay-Z and Nas, which presumably involves money changing hands. Whereas for him, they just got one of his photos and stuck it on a blog. And he's kind of annoyed he didn't get the official Robin Hood gig. And that's why he's now so angry. But maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe he wouldn't have even done a formal marketing partnership, which involved him being paid lots of money, given his apparent opinion of this app and the wider Robin Hood company.
Now, Robin Hood does have an answer for all this. It hasn't officially filed a defence with the court yet, but it did give a statement to various media after Ice Cube's lawsuit was filed. And it insists that it properly licensed its use of the Ice Cube photo via the agency that controls the copyright in that image. And that the Robin Hood Snacks website and app, it's just an editorial service, meaning that the photo was being used for editorial and not advertising purposes, and therefore the company did not make use of Ice Cube's image for any promotional purposes.
Yeah, and I guess that's key, because Ice Cube isn't claiming to own the copyright in the photo that they used, so they probably did get that property license from whichever agency owns the copyright in the photo. He is accusing Robin Hood of infringing his trademark rights and his publicity rights and so on and so forth. And actually, although this is a fun lawsuit just because how forthright it is in dissing this company, but it is potentially quite interesting, because I guess what Ice Cube's lawyers are saying is, yeah, okay, this is a blog, it's an editorial service. And so, you know, if you're media and you illustrate a story with a celebrity, providing you are not infringing the copyright in the photo, so either you own the copyright in the photo or you license it from an agency or it's provided to you by a PR agency or whatever, providing you're not infringing the copyright, you know, you can use pictures of celebrities to illustrate your stories. And you're not going to be accused of infringing trademark or publicity rights or anything like that because, well, if trademark and publicity rights could stop media from using relevant pictures to illustrate a story, you get massively into trademark, etc., infringing on freedom of speech. So, for a media site, what Robin Hood have said is a really legitimate, strong defense. But obviously, what the Ice Cube lawyers are saying is, okay, yes, this is a blog. It's kind of editorial, but it only exists for one reason, which is to flog all of the other Robin Hood services. So although it is kind of editorial, really it's advertising, really it's marketing, because the only reason this editorial exists is to promote the rest of the Robin Hood business. Now, I think I'm right in saying that what is called Robin Hood Snacks actually began life as another news service that Robin Hood then bought and rebranded, which I guess potentially helps Robin Hood's defense that no, this is legitimate editorial. It's not just a blog that's really there for promotional purposes. But I mean, if all of this does get to court, which it almost certainly won't, but if it does, a lot of companies these days have a blog or a website or a newsletter where they write about and report on things which are either relevant to what they do as a business, or sometimes if they're a company that does sponsorship in music or sport or culture. They write about that sort of stuff. So they basically have a thing over here that is basically editorial, it is media, but it only really exists to help promote a brand and to sell services and to build data about customers and stuff like that. And I suppose that is an interesting grey area of, well, if editorial exists, but really it only exists to flog some services, then do the companies that run those sites have the protections that you would expect as media, as journalists, you know, providing you're not infringing anybody's copyright, you don't have to worry about people's trademarks and publicity rights. Or are we saying if the content only exists as a marketing tool, so therefore it's a sophisticated form of advertising, then actually, if you start randomly putting celebrities' photos into your blog, it's implying endorsement, and that then gets into trademark publicity rights territory. I don't know. I suspect it won't get to court, so they won't be having that conversation. You could say, yeah, CMU's interesting, isn't it? It has one website over here that's all editorial, and then it has another website over here, which is all about training courses and music business consultancy. So maybe we have...
Yeah, I was going to say, do sign up for those free panels.
So yeah, you might think CMU has a bit of a vested interest here, because if they start saying that companies that have both a media side and a other side to the business, and maybe the media helps promote the other side of the business... Yeah, well, it's interesting. Let's just say that.
But CME existed as a media first. The other side just came later. If anything, I would say the other bits of the company promote the media.
Well, you
that's
might say that.
At CMU.
You might say that about CMU.
I would.
But
mainly because that's the bit I run. And so it's therefore it's more important.
But Robinhood, okay, they're not going to say that the app exists to promote the news service. But they could say in the same way, well... Robinhood Snacks, because it existed, as I say, as I understand it, as a standalone website before it got bought by Robinhood, they could say something similar in, well, that media service existed before it became part of Robinhood, so therefore it is a legitimate editorial service. So just because we put a photo of a celebrity on our website does not imply endorsement. It's editorial. Go away, is what they could say. And almost certainly will say, if this gets to court, which it probably won't, but... We occasionally recommend downloading lawsuits and having a good read. And if you can find this lawsuit, it's online. You can download it from the court's website. Yeah, it's quite amusing just because they really, really go above and beyond in trying to portray this company as being the most immoral, evil, inept, horrible company that has ever existed. And that's quite amusing.
And all because of a photo on a blog. Oh, and obviously using... The thing we've learned here... is that Ice Cube has a catchphrase, or what he would consider his official catchphrase. And that is now a matter of law, that Ice Cube has a specific catchphrase that is his.
Yeah, so if he ever wants to pursue a career as a stand-up comedian, he can take what we thought was a lyric and turn it into a comedy catchphrase.
Oh, imagine that. Ice Cube's... Well, Ice Cube's done comedy stuff, hasn't he? He's done films. He's been a comic actor. So I could see him doing a sketch show where he's just a recurring character who says, check yourself before you wreck yourself. That could be an amusing punchline in any number of situations.
Well, I look forward to seeing that show coming to fruition.
Maybe this lawsuit is just a way of promoting that show and it's already being made.
Yeah, maybe it is. Should stress, this lawsuit was not filed on the 1st of April. I think it was filed on the 31st of March. Otherwise, maybe it was an elaborate April Fool's ruse to launch Ice Cube's comedy career as a catchphrase-based sketch comedian. But that is not it. A, because the lawsuit was not filed on the 1st of April. And B, because that is not what the lawsuit is about.
Anyway, that is all we've got time for this week. No more time for any catchphrases whatsoever. Although, I suppose maybe you could say the things... that I say right at the end here are my catchphrase. Who knows? See what you think. Anyway, that's all we've got time for. Do the subscribing, rating, reviewing, all of that stuff that really helps in ways that podcasters say it does. Email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. If you have any questions or comments about anything we've discussed here, Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
The
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.